Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday, 18th August, 1987. If two men, J and B, are conversing together, J thinks that he comprehends what B is saying to him. J may even imagine that he fully understands B. This is a common illusion. Only up to a point, J does comprehend and understand B. Each and every person is unique. As such, the meaningful content of whatever he says is something quite special to him. It is almost impossible to convey this meaningful mental content fully and exactly through its verbal formulation. Since the listener has his own conditioned meaningful content for the words used, the actual communication that takes place is not quite what was intended or expected. Note, for instance, how often the listener says to himself or to the speaker, "What exactly do you mean by that?" There are, of course, exact and meaningful contents to many purely factual statements in everyday use. For example, the 1987 Buddhist Summer School is being held at Haili Conference Center. The weekly charge is 2x plus 3y pounds per head. Dinner is at 7 p.m. Professor Barker will give the evening lecture. Now, no one can misunderstand that or incompletely understand it. But if the speaker is giving a lecture on Dhamma or on some philosophical subject, especially if it plumbs the depths or scales the heights, the listener may well fail to absorb the full meaningful content of what is presented to him. Even the speaker himself may be hard put to it to find adequate phraseology to express the true content of his perception or his conscious realization. Moreover, his skill and power to convey what he is saying depends upon the intensity of his own consciousness of what he intends to say, and upon the mysterious, silent influence of his own presence upon his listener. If that influence enhances the open-minded receptivity of the listener and awakens his consciousness, the talk will prove profitable to speaker and listener alike. The listener will be enriched and the speaker will have learnt fruitful lessons. This holds good in greatest measure when the speaker is a Buddha or one of his great arahants. Any earnest speaker speaks or tries to speak from the depth of his heart and from the profoundest level of his consciousness. And in the case of the perfected holy ones, that depth of heart and profundity of consciousness is transcendent. But being a lord of compassion and wisdom, a Buddha tempers his talk to suit the capacity for understanding by the listener. The Lord tempers the wind for the shorn lamb. Nevertheless, being a Buddha, an arahant possessed of holistic consciousness, which is at home in the context of infinity and eternity, the quality and substance of what he gives out will necessarily carry with it the characteristics of that transcendent context. These will therefore remain beyond the ken of the ordinary listener who is conscious in the restricted context of finitude and temporality. This does not mean that the man of the world, the Puthujjana, will suffer any loss when the perfected Holy One speaks. Provided the particular Puthujjana attends as carefully as he can to what is said or written, he will receive that proportion of its full import which lies within his capacity to understand at that time. You cannot fill a vessel more than its actual containing capacity. If you apply yourself studiously to the living of the holy life as you walk through the corridors of time, you will find increasing depth and greater wealth in what you receive, although the verbal form of what is given you remains unchanged. Have you not heard it said, "I am reading your book for the fourth time, and I find new and deeper meanings each time"? As you all know, there are a few key words in the Buddha's teaching. For example, dukkha, tanha, magga, nibbana, etc. The teaching, forged in the fires of tribulation, perfected in the light of wisdom, and shaped by the heart of boundless compassion, is such a lovely whole that to understand the meaning of any one of those key words illumines the whole of his all-healing teaching. The Lord said, this comes in the Majjhima 140, the Alagaddupama Sutta, "Formerly, monks, as well as now, I simply make known dukkha and the utter ending of dukkha. Announcing the four noble truths, the first one lays down," you'll find the fullest description in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, "jati, birth, or the conditioned state, is dukkha. Old age is dukkha. Maranam, death, is dukkha. Grief, lamentation, suffering, misery, and despair, soka parideva dukkha domanasa upayasa, is dukkha. Not to get what is wished for is dukkha." In short, the five groups that arise from grasping in terms of rupa, vedna, sanya, sankhara, vijnana are all connected with dukkha. The Buddha presented dukkha comprehensively for his day. 25 centuries have passed by since then. So, perhaps, we may be permitted to make a modern presentation which is more or less comprehensive for our day. Look where we may, there we see suffering. The suffering caused by hunger, disease, homelessness, loneliness, frustration, fear, failure, anxiety, worry, perplexity. There is the pain of growing up, of misfortune or lack of opportunity. We know the ache of love, the agony of hate, the seething misery of jealousy, the wasting bitterness of unfulfillment. we bear the burden of looking after possessions, of shouldering too many responsibilities, of slaving for mere existence. Boredom crushes us. The sharp goad of conscience, the unwelcome necessity for making certain decisions, the cruel thrust of fate, the malignity of circumstance, the trial of separation from loved ones, or of being forced into an uncongenial environment, all these cause suffering. There is the sorrow of being misunderstood, unappreciated, ill-treated, the laceration of futile longing for the look that is never given, the word that is never spoken, the letter that never comes, the tearing of the heart by the bad, cruel, or faithless husband or wife, by the beloved who will not disengage herself graciously or humanly, by the friend who shuts his eyes or refuses to hear, the sudden stab by the parent who forgets to kiss and the teacher who fails to approve. There is the grief associated with old age and waning faculties. There is the torment of the condemned man in his cell, the oppression of ideologies, the hell of the concentration camp. There is the acute suffering of seeing others suffer, of one's own inability or helplessness to relieve misery, to right wrongs, to prevent disasters. There is the suffering which must be borne because sin and evil have to be endured till one is able, with help, to deal with them. There is piteous suffering due to our own ignorance, to our own stupidity, to remorse and regret. There is deep suffering due to intellectual travail. What is truth, goodness, justice, freedom, peace, love? What is the right way of life? Who or what is God, or whatever is the supreme? Is there, in fact, any God? And if there is God, the God presented by our heritage, how is evil so triumphant, pain and misery so universal? Life seems so meaningless, especially when we know the agony caused by the destruction of the good to which we gave ourselves, by the shattering of our ideals, by the discovery of the inadequacy, even of the falsity, of our sincere beliefs, our deep-seated convictions, by the annihilation of the foundations on which we had built our house of life. All pain is obvious suffering, but the thorn of suffering pierces every pleasure bud too, for there is no joyous meeting without the pain of parting overshadowing it, no feasting without its end in sight, no security without bondage, no freedom without uncertainty, no hope without fear and anxiety. There is no terminating of toil without beginning all over again. There is no acquisition, success or achievement for the separate self, but that the ego must buy it with death. There is the inconsolable grief of death, the death of a love, a cherished hope, an exalted ideal, the death of the companion since childhood days, of the comrade in the field, of the parent, of the life partner, of one's own child. The break in the intercourse is a scar on the heart of the living. It leaves its mark for all time. It makes a mockery of pious beliefs. It is like a derisive grin, unsanctifying all consolatory doctrines, a shade which steals away the sweet light of life. It harries a man like an avenging fury, so that he is driven willy-nilly to seek an insurance against the dark hereafter, and also against recurring present discomfort. It distracts him into forgetfulness of his true home, the eternal here now, and imprisons him in a fantastic web of his own weaving, the web of this world and that world, of the world of the flesh and the kingdom of God. There is supremely that agony of the dark night of the soul. No pulse, no God, only a silent abyss. A vast amount of suffering is due to our own lust, to our feverish pleasure-seeking and self-indulgence, to our greed and our ambition, aggressiveness, anger, jealousy, envy, hate, resentment, malice, and ill will, to our vanity, egoistic self-conception and self-seeking, to our own fixed beliefs, ideas and ideals, and the passion, always stupid, sometimes murderous, as in the case of authoritarian ideologies and totalitarian politics, to impose these beliefs, ideas and ideals on others, to our own pathetic illusions and sad delusions, to our ignorance of actual fact, material and psychological, and to fear. All such sources of suffering constitute evil. It is quite easy to see this if I observe my reactions to all stimuli, to my memories and anticipations, to the nature and shape of my fantasies and the course of my desires. If I am truly discerning, I can clearly perceive that all of them, centering round my I-ness, are burning with the fires of greed and hate and delusion. I like the taste of meat, so I kill, or am indirectly involved in butchery. I am enamored of that woman, so I lust after her, and I can indulge my passion at least in imagination without let or hindrance. I am attracted by that object, so I want to possess it. I have an aggressive ambition to amass wealth, to rise to fame, and succeed in great achievements. So I ruthlessly, cunningly, and with stifled conscience assert my supremacy over others, dominating them by any means or depriving them even of the necessities of existence. I have the passion of the ignorant and conceited to save souls. So I evangelize militantly, even become a Torquemada. I dislike this person or that thing, so I hurt the person or destroy the thing. I want to be safe and salved, so I act according to my delusion and live as an image, untrue to what I really am. All my passions, desires and thoughts, all ego-centered, arise out of my psyche. I am the originator and perpetuator of evil. My evil is the source of suffering for myself and my whole environment. We must note that every problem which arises in our life is basically due to our dualistically functioning consciousness, vijnana. enslaved as it is by our desires. Here in Britain, one of the sentiments of a patriotic poem most lustily sung is that Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. The fact is that Britons, like all the 5 billion members of the human race, are abject slaves of their desires, passions, beliefs, convictions, ambitions, and a whole host of evil things, producing dukkha, not only for ourselves individually, but also universally. Millions of animals brutally slain for sport or food, great rain-bearing forests senselessly destroyed, etc. The root source of all forces for evil is, of course, ignorance, avidya, Sanskrit avidya. In the Sammaditthi Sutta, Sariputta, the honored arahant, defines ignorance as not to know the four noble truths, dukkha, its cause, its extinction, the way to its extinction, that is the noble eightfold path. We must be careful how we understand avidya and its opposite vidya, usually translated as knowledge. It is not knowledge like the knowledge of cookery or algebra or piano playing. The root of the word is vid, which means to see. We have the saying, seeing is believing. Really to see means to be clearly and fully conscious of. Whatever we are thus conscious of, we can do perfectly. Remember Plato's teaching, you really know only what you can do. So we may affirm that what we are clearly conscious of will naturally and spontaneously express itself beautifully through all our thinking, feeling, speaking, doing. Thus, if at last we definitely see, are clearly conscious of, the fact that all that comes under the category of worldliness, of the finite and temporal, and hence the mortal, is dukkha, ill, evil. If we see that, the tentacle-like grip of avidya begins to slacken, and the entire structure of the 12 nidana paticca samuppada begins to crumble. Nidana means factor, and paticca samuppada, a profound insight of the Buddha, means dependent origination, or, to use the late Dr. Konzer's term, conditioned co-production. It is best understood as a circular chain of causal uprising. The first item conditions the second, which conditions the third, which conditions the fourth, and so on to the end. The 12 links are avidya, sankhara, vijnana, namarupa, salayatana, fassa, vedana, tanha, upadana, bhava, jati, jara, marana. We need not waste any time translating all those, you can read it in the books. With old age and death are associated grief, lamentation, sorrow, and despair. By the extinction of ignorance, it is said, all the other links are extinguished. Theoretically, that is so. Practically, one starts with tanha, craving. Be master of craving, and there is the end of all the factors composing the uprising of dukkha. Actually, all these factors interdepend. If any one is removed, the entire circular chain collapses. Picture it like this. 12 men stand in a circle. Each man's left palm presses the right shoulder blade of the man on his left, and his right palm presses on the left shoulder blade of the man on his right. Now, picture all of them pressing forward towards the center of the circle, each man bending from the waist. If any one man slips and falls, the whole lot tumble down. Somewhat like Jack and Jill who went up the hill. The Paticca Samuppada applies to our mental life, to the psyche, not to the whole psychophysical existential being as usually presented. Consider carefully the extinction process. Just the first four items: avidya, sankhara, vijnana, namarupa. The living person, the self-conscious existential being, is vijnana, namarupa, discriminative consciousness, psyche, body, psychophysical organism. If that is extinguished, the person is dead. That is the end of any paticca samuppada for him. It is the end of dukkha also, and of any possible nibbana or sambodhi for him. But if we see that the extinction of vijnana namarupa really means the extinction of the name and shape, the namarupa, of a feeling or a thought process, and also of the awareness, the vijnana, of that thought process, and see that it all derives from the state of ignorance, then the paticca samuppada makes good sense and is psychologically sound. Cut out all this business about previous lives and future lives and all the rest of it. This is what we can deal with practically here and now. The man himself is still alive, and so the paticca samuppada can still apply to the thought processes and the consciousness processes that arise in him throughout his life. It was not known in the days of the Buddha that evolution and heredity have determined and molded our body and brain, the rupa, and some of our sankhara. Other sankhara and our sanya are the conditioned products of our environment, nurture and training, and our own mental and physical activities. Body and brain are the product of hundreds of millions of years of gradual evolution, nature's work involving trial and error, selection and rejection, chance and probability and uncertainty. The general idea or the laws of karma are absolute is totally absurd, really. The universal process has definitely elasticity in it and flexibility. Remember that the universal process, the karmic process, is not rigidly deterministic. Elasticity and flexibility do operate in the universe, and predictability does have some limitations. The historical period, say the last 6 or 7 millennia, has seen the rise and fall of civilizations. Despite difficulties and errors, there has been a steady cultural growth and improvement on the whole in human relations and a development in human consciousness, which is an important pointer to the fulfillment of one of the main purposes of human existence, namely the realization of holistic consciousness, which outstandingly characterized the perfected holy ones of the historical period. We know the names of only a few of them: Zarathustra, Moses, Gautama the Buddha, Jesus the Christ, Sri Krishna. the great teachers of the Upanishads like Yajnavalkya, Shvetashvatara, Shakayanya, Satyakama Jabala, Nachiketas, King Pravahana Jaivali, Ajatashatru, King of Kasi, Uddalaka, Aruni, he was the one who said, Tattvam Asi, that art thou, and many others. The great poet seers of the Vedas, like Prajapati Parameshtin, Brihadeva, Vamadeva, and several others. The great Tibetan and Zen teachers, like Milarepa, Tsongkhapa, Tilopa, Naropa, Bodhidharma, Huineng and Huangpo, and we must never forget Lao Tzu and Kuan Tzu. In the Ishigili Sutta, the third volume of the Majjhima, the Buddha gives the names of over 100 Paccheka Buddhas and collectively mentions 500 Paccheka Buddhas. They are silent Buddhas. They don't teach. So our world has not been too short of perfected holy ones, even though mankind as a whole has been peculiarly blind to them. Our tragic blindness has brought untold dukkha into our lives. The ordinary context in which our consciousness functions is space and time, finitude and temporality. The perfect living of the Brahmacharya, the holy life, so that we can say in the Buddha's words, done is what had to be done, enables consciousness to develop to its culminating point, namely holistic consciousness, which is the supreme development possible for a member of the species Homo sapiens. Our ordinary everyday consciousness is vijnana, but this holistic consciousness is what the Buddha called vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pabam. Consciousness which is characterless, note carefully, which is characterless, endless, therefore beginningless, shining everywhere. And this, and those, that phrase of the Buddha, which comes twice, once in the Majjhima, once in the Digha Nikaya, it may come elsewhere, I haven't read all the Pali Canon. That is identical with the word Atma of the Upanishadic teachers. The perfected Holy One is the true human, the blissful creator. We, the innumerable multitude, are still subhuman. I don't use the word subhuman pejoratively. It simply means that we are at different stages on the way into growing into perfect humanness. The Buddha called the way the Majjhima Patipada, the middle way. He pointed out that on the one hand, the way of self-indulgence in a plethora of sense pleasures was no way to heal dukkha. On the other hand, the way of extreme asceticism was decidedly to be shunned, for it could lead most successfully to decrepitude and death. Read the latter part of the Mahasihanada Sutta, Majjhima 1, 77-81, for a detailed account of the ghastly practices to which Gautama subjected himself. The practices to which the great Christian mystic Henry Suzo subjected himself pale into insignificance beside Gautama's. Like Gautama, Suzo also saw the futility of asceticism. The middle way is not a compromise between being a sybarite and a self-tormentor, but it is a way of perfect austerity. Every item of the Buddha Magga is prefixed by Samma. to translate it as right, right this, right the other, is somewhat flabile. It aims at nothing short of perfection for the Puthujjana. You, the ordinary man, and I, the ordinary man, flower out into the Uttara or Mahapurusha, the Buddha, Lord of compassion and wisdom. The way is not flat and comfortable, nor sloping and exhilarating, nor even steep and dangerous. It is perpendicular and impossible. Therein lies its possibility, its ease, its safety, for holistic consciousness functions in the infinite eternal.